survive in this country wilderness. Swimming through the waters of Babylon like a rebel fish. Journalist, specialist, predator and survivalist. Spitting heaven fire from his lips. Burn the slave driver.
Welcome, listeners, to Time for an Awakening on Black Talk Radio Network, new media for the new millennia. This is a history and a current events program from a cultural perspective. We find this program necessary because Hosea 4:6 states, my people are destroyed for the lack of knowledge. But we as a people can turn this around. Proverbs 4:7 states, wisdom is the principal thing. Therefore, get wisdom, and with all thy getting, get an understanding. Again, welcome to the program this evening with your hosts, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. The number to reach us to join the conversation this evening is 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. We're streaming live at several locations. You can go to timeforanawakening.com, which is the homepage, and catch the live stream from that location. You can go to www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening. Again, that's www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening and catch the live stream there also. You can go to ourradionetwork.com. Again, that's ourradionetwork.com, which broadcasts out of the Black Belt, and catch the live stream there. Or you can download TuneIn to any of your handheld devices. TuneIn is a free app. And in that TuneIn search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening. There you'll see the icon, and you can stream the program live, even into your car if you have the Bluetooth capabilities or the auxiliary connection. Again, that's Time for an Awakening radio program with the live stream on the TuneIn app. Drop us an email at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Again, that's timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Time for Awakening also has a fan page on Facebook. In that Facebook search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening radio program. There you'll always see interesting content being posted daily. And do me a favor before you leave that page, just hit that like button. That's Time for an Awakening radio program with the fan page on Facebook, and Time for Awakening Media is there also, always with the latest podcasts of the various programs on Time for Awakening and interesting articles that you can read or download and share with your friends at later times. Again, make that one of your favorites. Put that in your address bar. That's timeforanawakening.com. Timeforanawakening.com will take you straight to Time for an Awakening Media. Tonight, we're scheduled to have a special guest join us, the treasurer of the Philadelphia chapter of Afrocentricity International and the former president general of the international headquarters of Marcus Garvey, UNIA chapter 121 here in Philadelphia, Brother Omawali Africa, is scheduled to join us this evening to talk about the organization Afrocentricity International, the missions and some of the projects that it's doing in the community here in the Philadelphia area. And we'll be right back to get the program started with our special guest after a brief word from our sponsors.
Mr. Moderator, our distinguished guests, brothers and sisters, our friends and our enemies. Everybody is here.
You're listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency and business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
Overworked? Suffering with an underperforming company, headache customer, staff, or vendors? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? We turned a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one transformation created for entrepreneurs like you in various industries around the country. Not what you're used to from accounting and business consulting? Well, welcome to New Business Solutions. If you're ready to go beyond advising, coaching, and training and get implemented results, call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions apply the best comprehensive administrative, accounting, operations, human resources, management, sales, and marketing to help you actualize your vision for yourself and your company. From anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072. Spelled new as in numerous on your device right now. Book your free consultation at newbusinesssolutions.com.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
From antiquity to the present, our people need to develop a new paradigm. It's time for an awakening. With your host, Brother Elliot. Sundays, 7 p.m., Fridays at 8 p.m. for podcasting or live program scheduling. Hit us up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. And before we get started with our program this evening, I want to welcome in my co-host, Philadelphia activist and tour guide at the African American Museum here in Philadelphia at 7th and Arch Street. Brother Richard is with us. Brother Richard.
Yes, sir, Brother Elliot.
How are you, sir?
I'm doing fine. It's a restful moment before we go into the made-up new year. I'm interested in hearing Brother Omawali Africa kind of assist in developing what they're fundraising for Afrocentricity International, but also hopefully a broader discussion of that centers around what's the purpose of the purpose at this moment in trying to assist in building an African collaborative movement.
You know, and this I guess it's just, this discussion tonight will be apropos because the day is the fifth day of Kwanzaa, which is near purpose, and you know. moving into, like you said, this calendar year of 2019, it should be a lot. It's going to be a lot of discussions because it's the 400th year of our ancestors being here on these shores. This discussion centered around our purpose. And it should have been going on, these type of discussions. But what should be our purpose now? You might find a segment of us that want equality. Some of them might not say it, but they want assimilation. But if you do a reflection, just like we just played the clip of Dr. John Henry Clark saying history is a clock that tells people our political and cultural time of day. If you use history as a barometer, you'll see that our ancestors always wanted freedom and sovereignty. So should that be our purpose now? And if it is, how should we go about trying to attain that? Let's go into discussion with our special guest this evening, Treasurer of Philadelphia Chapter of Afrocentricity International and former President General of the International Headquarters of Marcus Garvey, Chapter 121 of the UNIA. Brother Omawale Africa is with us. Brother Omawale.
Peace, Brother Elliot, and peace, Brother Rich.
How's everybody? Yeah, how you doing now?
How are you, sir?
Doing good. I can't complain. You know, looking forward to this conversation tonight.
Yeah, you know what? Like I was saying to Brother Richard a minute ago, it's going to be a lot of discussions coming up in this quote-unquote new calendar year centering around us, our existence here, and our purpose moving forward. Before we get started and talking about things centering around different fundraisers and different activities that Afrocentricity International is doing in the community, talk a little bit about the organization. I'm kind of familiar with the founders of the organization, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, Dr. Ama Mazama and my good friend, Dr. Malefe Keti Asante. Brother Omawale, tell the listening audience, if they're not familiar, about the organization, its missions, and things of that nature.
Yeah, you are correct. The organization Afrocentricity International was founded by Dr. Malefi Asante and Dr. Amazama back in 2011. So Afrocentricity International is a global Pan-African organization that was built and modeled after Marcus Garvey's UNIA. Dr. Asante and Dr. Mazama got together back in 2011, and their concern was that they didn't see an organization that was currently operating globally to assist with directing the efforts of African people, no matter where we are, to assist with bringing us together across borders, across languages, for the purpose of working collectively to achieve that sovereignty or that liberation that our ancestors were fighting for. So they decided to create an organization, which is Afrocentricity International. Within our org, we have four tenets that we work across. It's our politics, intellectualism, economics, and spirituality, with spirituality probably being the most pressing matter that we are trying to bring to bear on the movement towards Black liberation, because we feel that it's not possible for us as a people to obtain our liberation, to obtain our freedom while still being chained to the religions of our enslaver. So we believe that without a return to the traditions and spirituality of our ancestors, we'll never truly be free. So that's one of the things that we're looking to spearhead as an organization.
You know, and it's interesting that you talked about those four, I guess you would term qualities or missions of the organization.
Yes.
I'd like to kind of go into those. But before I do that, because some of those, there's a couple of those that might take some detailed discussion. Describe what Pan-Africanism means to you, Brother Omawale.
Well, for me, I think that, you know, first and foremost, in order for you to be Pan-African, I think that you first have to be African, right? And I think that, you know, working towards that African identity is something that we've always struggled with within the diaspora, because many of us do not want to be African. We don't want to be associated with anything African. And so much so that a perfect way to denigrate any movements that are African-centered is to just write them off as back to Africa movements, and then black people will throw them away because no one is interested in returning to Africa, right? So with that being said, in order to be Pan-African, or what Pan-Africanism means to me, it's basically us as African people, no matter where we are across the globe, working collectively towards the operation of aspiration of African liberation and our sovereignty as a people. So that's how I would define Pan-Africanism. And I guess more specifically, or more importantly, is our collective work should be geared towards the overthrow of this system that currently oppresses us, no matter where we are as a people.
You know, go ahead, Richard. Go ahead.
I wanted to... your Afrocentricity International is putting on a particular campaign right now, and wanted to do, and I also wanted to address those tenets that you raised.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm taking that the campaign is to assist and the organization in doing that. Why is that important at this point right now for the organization to have this kind of campaign, and what kind of campaign is it?
So the campaign that you're referring to is our Reclaim Your Heritage campaign. Back in November of this year, November 25th, we launched a fund called the African Heritage and Cultural Preservation Fund. And the purpose of this fund is to help assist us in pooling our resources for the purpose, right? I keep saying purpose. I guess today, with it being the fifth day of Kwanzaa and Nia, purpose has a lot of place in this conversation, but the purpose of this particular fund is to help us as African people pool our resources collectively for the purpose of building institutions all across the African continent and throughout the diaspora, institutions that will serve to re-educate and re-socialize people as it relates to African spirituality. Our traditional spiritual systems have been so denigrated over the past 400 years that much of what we know of these systems are based on myth or Hollywood demonology, or even, Judeo-Christian demonology. You know, many of us are familiar with Pat Robertson, during the earthquake down in Haiti, went on national TV and said it's for reasons, the reason why, Haiti was being flooded is because, the Haitians made a pact with the devil and became devil worshippers in order to win their sovereignty or their freedom as a people. So what we're trying to do with these institutes is, undo a lot of that miseducation, but also create an environment where these practices and our spirituality can once again flourish. We truly believe that, the sacredness of African people will not be restored without a restoration of the sacredness of African tradition. So that's the work that we're about with this project.
If I may, Elliot, and going to Brother Umuwali Africa, the interesting thing, and this is my position when we are dealing with our heritage and reclaiming our spirituality. And I wanted to focus on that and ask you to kind of, how do you see defining that? But the problem I usually have challenge when we have these, and it's more general discussion, is people tie African spirituality to religion. And so my question to you, do you see that African spirituality is religion, or is it, as I'm projecting, something different, that it is the center of our social, of our beingness, our social, economic, our identity? That's what our spirituality is in relationship to our practice. And that's what was the war was against. Do you see spirituality as something that relates to our religion or something else? And that's the question I would.
Yeah, I think that when it comes to African spirituality, religion would definitely be the wrong way to describe it. Right? Typically, when we think of religion, we think of these, I guess, revealed doctrines where somebody either floated up into the sky and you know, a sky god gave them direction on how to lead humanity, or, you know, a sky god spoke to somebody in the desert and, you know, told them to write down, you know, laws or whatever it may be. That's typically, you know, when we think of religion, it's typically Islam, Christianity, Judaism. That African spirituality is much more than what we would consider just religion. It is the center of all things that we do. It's the center of our social life. It's the center of our economic life. It's the center of our political life. When you look historically at pre-colonial Africa in terms of how societies were erected and the hierarchy of societies, right? The hierarchy of our society was based upon the hierarchy that we envisioned in the cosmos, right? So we tried to structure a society that was in alignment with the divine nature of the universe. So I guess, yeah, to answer your question, our spiritual practices are much more broader than what people refer to as a religion. This isn't something that you do, you know, every Sunday or every Wednesday night. This is something that is, you know, central to your life and how you design or live your life.
And just to give a historical operational example that here, you know, in Time for Awakening, we use all the time is IT, right? And Bookman, you know, the whole thing of Vudan. Organizing that whole revolution, the primary impetus in the structure. And Elliot, I think the brother we had from Brazil made the same reference, was around that spiritual practice. It wasn't just something that, you know, having faith in, but it was an organizing principle in relationship to even going into warfare. So I think that, you know, we have to understand that. So when I hear you saying that this here campaign that you're on to fight against the negative images, is that what you're saying, that Afrocentricity International and its Reclaim Your Heritage, these are the images that you're trying to, you need resources and support in order to combat? Because even today, the Vudan or African spiritual practices is projected as something evil, close to the what in religion is called the devil worship.
Yeah, and you know what's ironic about that is the reason why African spirituality, whether, you know, Voodoo, Vudan, you know, any of the different branches that come from this particular tree or this particular source. The reason why it's deemed as evil and why Black people fear it in many cases is because white people fear it. And white people fear it for good reason. You just mentioned the African Revolution that founded the nation of AET and Bookman's Prayer, you know, where he told the people it was time for us to abandon this white Jesus and embrace the deities or the divinity of our ancestors, right, and our own gods. And that prayer that sparked a revolution that freed the people of Haiti and actually ended the slave trade as we know it. And the importance of this and the reason why you know that it has played a significant role in even shaping the diaspora, and I'm talking about African spirituality. If you look back, there was a book written in the 19th century. It was called The Religious Instruction of the Negro from 1804 to 1863. Mm-hmm. And they start with 1804 particularly because this is when Haiti officially became an independent nation. But the reason why they start with 1804 is because coming off that revolution, the conversations start to happen here in the U.S. where they saw African spirituality as a significant threat, and they needed to create some type of missionary enterprise or apparatus where you could Christianize the Africans that were here in America, right? Because even up until the late 19th century, in fact, as late as 1890, the majority of Africans in America were still practicing some form of African spirituality. For example, when they had the Mohonk Conference in 1890, Rutherford B. Hayes was then the ex-president at the time, but he presided over the conference. And they were very clear in saying, the large majority of Africans in this country are practicing some form of voodoo, but B, they saw this practice as a matter of national security, right? So they couldn't have, you know, this white supremacist project be secure and operate and be what they wanted it to be for their progeny, while black people were still worshiping the deities and the divinity of their ancestors, right? So they needed to do away with that. So that's why we see going out of the 19th century and coming into the 20th century, the church starting to flourish. But Du Bois actually speaks to this very clearly when he published his book, The Souls of Black Folk, in 1903. He speaks to the fact in chapter 10, The Faith of Our Fathers, he speaks to the fact that the early Christian church was in no ways Christian. And he explicitly states that the early Christian church in America, or the early Christian black church, could be characterized in what we refer to as voodoo heathen rites. And I'm quoting Du Bois here, right? So over generations, you know, we lost that with the many attacks that occurred on voodoo, the attacks that occurred at the beginning of the 20th century and all throughout the 20th century. Via Hollywood and via Christianity, to the point now that the propaganda has been so effective that when our people hear words like the term voodoo or hear words like zombie, for instance, they are completely afraid, because Hollywood has associated these words with devil worship and demon worship and bloodlust, you know, when that's the furthest thing from the truth. And that's why we're doing work to build these institutions to actually re-educate our people, but also to create the conditions necessary to bring about African sovereignty.
Hey, Brother Omowale, when you have these community discussions and invite people in, because I see a lot of the announcements that go out, I get them in my email feed. The question, because these four tenets that you're talking about is vitally important to us moving forward, and they need intensive discussions on several of them. One of them is spirituality. It's just as you and Richard just started talking about. We talk about that a lot on Time for Awakening. A lot of people want to avoid that topic because it's what they consider controversial, and battle lines is immediately drawn. But we need critical discussion on the things that we put faith in and totally believe in. It has to be critical discussion on it. In fact, we talk Friday about briefly about that book by Charles Colquitt Jones, the one that you just talked about, The Religious Instruction of the Negro. And we did it in relationship to the manuscript of this slave Bible that they put in a museum in Washington. They also have it in a museum in Europe, in Britain, with a version of what they consider the King James Bible. What is the King James Bible? But it's a version that was used for our ancestors, with large portions of the quote unquote Old and New Testament removed, and just given portions of it to our people. And the portions that was given to our people was deemed the Word of God. So, you know, it has to be discussions on these things, and critical discussions. How do you approach these things when you're talking about them? Because like I said before, when you mention these things, you mention religion right away, battle lines are drawn. So how do you get the people, without going into deep detail, how do you get the people to discuss these topics without them feeling offended?
Well, I typically embrace it as an educational exercise.
Okay.
Right. So I try to, frame the conversation historically, right? So I actually use historical texts.
Okay.
To show why our spirituality was taken away from us, right? I can go into the text and I can show you where the writers were explicitly stating that, you know, it was a matter of national security. It was a matter of safety. It was easier for them to maintain the slave enterprise by Christianizing us. So I try to historicize the conversation. And by doing that, you at least open people up to the curiosity and to be willing to even entertain a conversation about some of these historical practices.
Excellent.
Right. Or another way that I'll do it is I'll take a term that has been demonized, that people are afraid of, and then I'll give them the real definition of what that term actually means, right? I have a few that I do it with. Like I'll say voodoo, right? Immediately when most of us think of voodoo, we think of something demonic or, you know, think of all the pictures that Hollywood has put into our mind. Mm-hmm. But the term voodoo comes from the Fon word, which is simply means the spirit is with us, right? And Sister Baina Bello tells us, and Baina Bello is a Mambo out of Haiti. Mm-hmm. She tells us in all things we do, we should know that the spirit is with us, right? Another term, I use the term zombie, right? This is something that has been denigrated, right? Heavily, right? When we think of zombies, again, this is something else that we get from Hollywood of dead people running around, eating other people, very scary people, right? And why do they denigrate it? Why? Because it's also a term that comes out of African spirituality. The term zombie actually comes from the West African word insambi, right? Which means the spirit. Right. Another term I use just to start conversations, to educate people, to even open them up to it. You know, oftentimes when we're talking, you'll hear somebody say, oh, that person is just talking mumbo jumbo. Right. And I'll say, well, do you know what mumbo jumbo means? Oh, mumbo jumbo is a bastardization of a Mandinka deity. Right. The Mandinka people were a tribe or nation of people on the western hemisphere on the western coast of Africa. Right. And that was one of their deities that was highly revered, right? But when Europeans came over, right, and bastardized or demonized or denigrated our deities, now when we speak every day, we say, oh, that person's just talking mumbo jumbo, right? So what I'm doing by doing that is, A, I'm, you know, throwing away or challenging the current paradigm that exists as it relates to our position towards African spirituality, but I'm also elevating it to the position of sacred so that people can then say, okay, well, tell me more. You know, what more do you have to share? And then I can go into, you know, more of the political or war-related reasons why these practices were taken from us. I'll give you another example.
Mm-hmm.
West Africa. One of the things that we don't hear about is the resistance movements to colonialism during the late 19th, early 20th century, right? So one of the movements that we never hear about is a movement called the Ekumeko movement of West Africa. Now, this was a movement of African people on the African continent, mostly Igbo people, but there were other tribes who put their tribal designations to the side and became one group, right? This was an early act of Pan-Africanism, but that's actually Pan-Africanism used to fight the invasion of the colonizers. And what they would do is any European missionaries that came, you know, into the land, into the interior, they would kill. Any merchants that came into the interior, they would kill. And any mercenaries and military men, right, they would kill, right? And the entire thrust of that movement was African spirituality. Another significant movement, there was a resistance movement down in Zimbabwe, and there was a sister named Mbuya Nihanda. Now, this sister was a spirit medium, and they used African spirituality to severely resist the British, so much so to the point that when they finally captured her, they hung her in Zimbabwe. But before they hung her, they said, if you just renounce your religion and become Christian, we'll allow you to live. And she said, I will never renounce my religion, and go ahead and hang me, because even in my death, my bones shall rise. Right? So it's giving people back these stories, but also showing the lies that have been told about our practices and why they will be central to us picking them back up in order for us to truly regain our independence and our sovereignty on this planet as African people.
Great.
You know, mm-hmm. if I may, Elliot, I wanted to pick up on a thought on that in the sense of, well, two, because I wanted to be clear of what the heritage, you know, the Reclaim Your Heritage is, campaign is, and what you would like to achieve. But I'm also interested in this as you're framing it, or as we're framing it in this discussion, because one thing that you started off earlier saying about African identity, you know, the concept of African identity being something that in North America specifically, a project that we worked on. I mean, as you implied, there were a lot of different African ethnic nations that came into these shores to be enslaved. And what the leadership did was create, in a way, an intellectual concept, construct to try to unify. And that was the construct of being African. So one question is this Reclaim Your Heritage a part of that historical project? And two, then what goals are you looking at through Afrocentricity in the continuation, if that is true, the continuation of that project as far as in the development of the African identity?
Yeah, I would absolutely say that we are a part in a continuation of that historical project, right? This project of Pan-Africanism or of embracing African identity as a means of achieving the necessary unity to fight and to win, right? Our model for the organization, we say that unity is our aim and victory is our destiny, right? But another thing that we often state is that consciousness precedes unity. And the consciousness part, you know, I think that that's where we play a significant role in working to raise the consciousness of our people as a consciousness-raising organization, right? Because we understand that your consciousness shapes your behavior, right? And your behavior shapes your conditions. So if you can change the conditions of a people, you can also change the behavior. And if you can change the behavior, ultimately, I say that incorrectly, if you can change the consciousness of a people, you can change the behavior. And if you can be change the behavior, ultimately, you can change your conditions. Now, the work that we're doing with this new project, the African Heritage and Cultural Preservation Fund, your listeners can check. We have a website that I would like for them to view. The website is www.reclaimyourheritage.fund. That's .fund, F-U-N-D. But the work is very unique in that we're working across three of the areas of the nine areas of key people activities. If you're familiar with Nellie Fuller's assessment of the nine areas of key activities.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so the three that we're working across are education, economics, and religion. And this is strategic, and let me explain to you why. From an education perspective, the work that we're doing with the fund is we are looking to create these institutes that re-socialize our people. And a part of that re-socialization is actually our people taking on an African identity, but also us undoing a lot of the miseducation that they've received over the years in order to maintain us in the current place that we are across the globe, right? So that's what we're doing from the education perspective. But economically, the work that we're doing through this fund is we're trying to ensure that our people can be self-sufficient and self-sustaining. And the way that we're doing that, we have a model that's twofold. Part of the model is based upon agriculture, where, you know, if you can feed yourself, if you can produce what you eat, then you are in a better position to be secure and be self-determining. And then the other aspect of that is financial, where we're trying to create the conditions for small business growth and development. And the way we will be doing that is assisting through what they refer to as microloans or microfinance. Now, you have a lot of NGOs currently on the African continent that are giving microfinance, but the way that they do it is for their own interests, right? So the way that, let's say, an NGO that's associated with, like, America, in order for you to gain access to those resources from the NGO, those microloans, there'll be some caveats attached to the money. They typically only give to women in the community, and they have their reasons for doing that, for disturbing the economic balance of the community. But the important part of when they're targeting women, they're saying that in order for you to get this money, you need to take some education on childhood planning, i.e. open yourself up to more abortions or even to sterilization. Other caveats that come attached to the money, you know, you may have to be open to promoting or learning about homosexuality, right? And that's from a secular perspective, right? When you have money that's attached to private institutions like the Catholic Church, and we see this all the time. I mean, this was the initial missionary thrust, right? Once I destroy your culture And once I take the land from you, now I control your economy. And the only way for you to survive is to find a place within my economy. But you can't get access to my economy or the resources of my economy unless you convert to my religion. Right. So oftentimes the missionary enterprise would not just be a religious institute. It would also be an education and economic institute. Right. So you come through the missionary school. You get the education that's required for you to work in colonial administration. Right. So then you actually have a job helping to facilitate the theft of the resources of your land. But in order for you to get that job, to get access to the resources that they stole from you in the first place, you have to abandon your religion. You have to abandon your culture, take on a Christian name, and worship a Christian God in order to survive, right? So the economic component of what we're doing through the fund is addressing that, right? Our people won't be vulnerable to economic coercion if they can feed themselves and if they can create their own economic opportunities. Then we don't have to worry about people coming from the outside and saying, hey, you need to promote homosexuality or we're not going to give you money, or you need to build this Chinese Confucius Institute or we're not going to give you money, or you need to, you know, embrace Christianity or embrace Islam or we're not going to give you money. We're creating the conditions, the economic conditions for African spirituality to once again reemerge. But more importantly than just reemerging, we're creating the conditions for it to flourish. And that's the significant work of what we're doing through this fund.
We're in conversation with the treasurer of the Philadelphia Chapter of Afrocentricity International and the former President General of the International Headquarters of Marcus Garvey, UNIA Chapter 121, Brother Omawale Africa, is with us in discussion, talking about the mission and current outreach of Afrocentricity International. Brother Omawale, you're a brother of a certain age, in his 30s. To some folks, you would be considered a young brother. But talk about the term Afrocentric. That might be, to some people, a relatively new term. But talk about it and what it means to, what it would mean, especially to a certain generation now, to be Afrocentric.
Yeah, so the term Afrocentric, it's funny. Like all words, it's had its evolution, okay. Right? It was initially first used in the writings of Kwame Nkrumah, and then throughout the 70s, you saw people here, specifically in the diaspora, begin to use the term Afrocentric throughout the late 70s. People like Dr. Jacob Carruthers, you would see it in his writing. But who is most associated with it is Dr. Malefi Asante, because of his what Dr. Asante did was, he actually built a philosophy or a theory around being Afrocentric, or what it means to be Afrocentric, or the theory of Afrocentricity, right? And this is a theory that's actually taught like on college campuses. But with the rise and fall of the Afrocentric movement, what you saw throughout the late 80s going into the 90s was Afrocentric became more associated with, a style of dress, right? It had nothing to do with consciousness. People would be Afrocentric based upon the way they wore their hair, or if they wore the shiki, they would say that person is Afrocentric. But at its core, and this is the definition that I like to operate off of, at its core, being Afrocentric is a state of being, right? It's a state of consciousness, which means that A, you are clear on who you are and what it means to be an African person. But more importantly, you are acting to bring about a reality where African people can once again thrive. We like to call that the African Renaissance. And to act, right, Dr. Asante always talks about the critical question of African agency, right? Agency or to have power. Power simply just means the ability to act, right? So when you're saying you're Afrocentric, to be Afrocentric, it's inherently a political but also a cultural state of being, which shows that, A, you are clear on who you are as an African person, but more importantly, what you need to do as an African person to bring about the African Renaissance.
if I can, does that and I know this is loaded because we've had discussion around this before. It's two uncomfortable questions I may be asking in order to deal with heritage, if y'all don't mind. One is the whole thing of heritage, because there is some discussion around, especially Africans in North America, we being descendants of enslaved people, and that we should frame our heritage and our identity around that descendancy, you know. And the other uncomfortable question is, what it is to, out of our heritage, to be engaged in the political process. So what I'm trying to bring them two together, just between us to have this dialogue, how do you see if there is any challenge around Africans born in North America, descendants of slaves, supporting a heritage campaign that also deals with Africans on the continent? And do we, because we are centered in our Africanness, does that exclude us from being engaged in the political process? Hopefully that wasn't too much.
I'll probably need you to ask the second part of the question again, but I think I understood the first part of the question in terms of the identity of what they refer to, this new identity, this new Black American identity of descendants of slaves.
Right.
And you're asking, is that complementary to the work that we're doing with the African heritage and culture?
Right.
Okay. So, and you preface this by saying that this might be somewhat of I forget the word that you use.
Uncomfortable.
Well, no, it's not. I wouldn't say that it's uncomfortable at all. But what I would say is that this descendant of slave movement, in my mind, when I listen to many of the leading spokespeople of that movement, like Yvette Carnell, what I see it as, and this isn't anything new, to be clear, I think that there's always been this type of Black American or nativist movement within our population here in North America. So this isn't a new movement.
Mm-hmm.
But its chief aim and objective is really to gain recognition as an American for the purpose of gaining access to the resources of America, right? And what I look at it, for me, the analogy is this, imagine America being an elevator or a train. And let's say America is a train, and this train is about to go through the tunnel. Now, Black people in America are jumping onto this train so that we don't get left behind. However, half of our body or our arm is stuck in the door. So the question becomes, when it relates to being a descendant of a slave or being an African, being an African in my mind is being that whole body. But being a descendant of a slave is I'm going to go ahead and lose this arm and lose this leg because I need to get on this train, because if I don't get on this train, I'm going to suffer. So let me go ahead and lose half my body. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, I understand. I understand the metaphor as far as being able to explain the wholeness and what we're asking for. And I'm tying that too, because you're saying that part of the body being lost and getting on the train is being engaged in the being engaged into the politics of America. So does that preclude that being the whole body, does that preclude us being engaged in the politics of America, i.e. If one of the political agendas is of the whole body is reparation, does that preclude that as part of our heritage?
Well, I wouldn't say that it precludes it, right? Because I think that we've used the political situation here in America to try and get some gains during our time since we've been here. But the question for me becomes, you know, what is your ultimate goal? You know, and if your ultimate goal is truly sovereignty, right, then you have to ask yourself the question, is engaging in the political system here in America an effective strategy to get you to where you're trying to go? And I think the problem that we often have with this conversation around engaging, you know, in electoral politics as Black people here in North America is we typically don't have honesty when it comes to this conversation. You have people who refer to themselves as nationalists or separatists or people who say that they want sovereignty. But when you measure out their actions and when you try to push their actions to the logical conclusion, what they're ultimately after is assimilation or integration, but they just don't want to admit it. And I think that that's the challenge when it comes to the electoral question.
We're going to take a brief break, and when we come back, we're going to continue this discussion because you opened up something, Richard, that I wanted to go down because we had Brother Omowale on our panel when we had a discussion around the need for African Senate politics. Great topic. We'll be right back. You can get involved in the conversation by dialing 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. We're in conversation with the treasurer of the Philadelphia Chapter of Afrocentricity International and the former president general of the international headquarters of Marcus Garvey, UNIA Chapter 121. Brother Omowale Africa is with us in discussion this evening. We'll be right back.
Listening to Time for an Awakening, Time for an Awakening, with host Brother Elliot and Brother Richard on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency and business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services if when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
I think you'll find, sir, that there will come a time when Black people wake up and become intellectually independent enough to think for themselves. As other humans are intellectually independent enough to think for themselves, then the Black man will think like a Black man, and he will feel for other Black people. And this new thinking and feeling will cause Black people to stick together. And then at that point, you'll have a situation where when you attack one Black man, you are attacking all Black men.
And this type of black thinking will cause all black people to stick together. And this type of thinking also will bring an end to the brutality inflicted upon black people by white people. And it is the only thing that will bring an end to it. No federal court, state court, or city court will bring an end to it. It's something that the black man has to bring an end to himself.
Preachers and leaders, you administrators, you teachers, you leaders, you are the worst. No cowardly, punctified leader will lead this new generation of young black men and women. Your day of leading them is finished. When you talk to young people, you can't feel that you're missing them. Parents, you can't feel when you're talking to your children that this is a new generation and they don't want to hear your compromising talk. Did you hear them in Ferguson tell Jesse, get the hell out of here? You ain't no leader. I was hurting for my brother because Jesse worked hard for our people. But time has moved on. And what was good yesterday ain't no good at all today. So either you become a new vessel so that new wine can be poured into the old wine. Your day of leading our people is over, and it will never come back to you again.
Damn it, we're still in the land of our bondage. We're still in the land of captivity. We're still a slave to the Democratic Party. Still a slave to the Republican Party. You can't even see a Freedom Party. You don't see it. You're a slave. I'm a slave. And unless we admit that we are slaves, then we can never get free. Never get free.
Democratic administration in Washington, D.C. The whites were evenly divided. It was the fact that you threw 80% of your votes behind the Democrats that put the Democrats in the White House. When you see this, you can see that the Negro vote is the key factor. And despite the fact that you are in a position to be the determining factor, what do you get out of it? The Democrats have been in Washington, D.C. only because of the Negro vote. They've been down there 4 years. And all other legislation they wanted to bring up, they brought it up and gotten it out of the way, and now they bring up you. And now they bring up you. You put them first, and they put you last. Because you're a chump. political chump.
So you could see that the government of America has been planning our demise. Any members of Congress here, any members of the civil rights movement that are here, you love this nation. You've suffered every indignity to make America better, that she might be great. And every time you forced her to make a law that was in our favor, they came right behind that law with skill and chicanery to make the law of non-effect. When it came to treating the citizens of African descent fairly, America failed. She put them in chains. The government put them on slave quarters, put them on auction blocks, put them in cotton fields, put them in inferior schools, put them in substandard housing, put them in scientific experiments, put them in the lowest paying jobs, put them outside the equal protection of the law, kept them out of their racist bastions of higher education, and locked them into positions of hopelessness and helplessness. The government gives them the drugs, builds bigger prisons, passes a three-strike law, and then wants us to sing God Bless America? No, no, no. Not God Bless America. God damn America, that's in the Bible, for killing innocent people. God damn America for treating her citizens as less than human. God damn America, as long as she tries to act like she is God and she is supreme.
Welcome back to Time for an Awakening, and we're in conversation this evening with our special guest, the treasurer of the Philadelphia chapter of Afrocentricity International and the former president general of the international headquarters of Marcus Garvey, UNIA chapter 121. Brother Omawale Africa is with us in discussion this evening with myself and Brother Richard. Brother Omawale.
Well, but excuse me.
Go ahead, before Richard.
You ask the question. He was the president, not the president general. I don't want any challenges from the international headquarters, from the Universal Negro Improvement Association around identification. But the president general Omawale wasn't president general of the division. He was the president of the division.
Okay, 121 here. Okay, I'm sorry.
Yes.
I'm sorry about that, Brother Omawale.
No worries. I appreciate you for correcting that, Brother Rich.
Brother Omawale, we had a panel discussion here, which you were part of the panel, in late October, in reference to the need for an African-centered party here in Philadelphia, especially among neighborhoods and areas in this city that we control population-wise. Because the city of Philadelphia is still predominantly black. Talk about that in relation to one of the tenets of Afrocentricity International being politics. You know, because it's kind of hard to get some of our people to understand the approach to this or the thrust that we were trying to get forth. It's not that that we want to use politics to to assimilate, and I'm not saying that you're saying this, I'm just saying this for clarification, or to become more American. But I think that, in fact, I know that we had political formations and politics long before there was an America, and we had interaction with Caucasians. So in order for us to get back to some of the things that we need to do as a people to formulate economics, spirituality, education among ourselves, it has to be a political formation, so to speak. And it's a strong need for some type of African-centered ethics and African-centered political formations among our people. Talk about that from your perspective. What do you think in reference to that?
Yeah, so and for this question, I can only speak from my individual perspective as it relates to politics. I can't necessarily speak for the organization Afrocentricity International.
Yes.
Now I can give you some information about what I know of AI's political stance, or at least as it relates to us, you know, in politics.
Well, give us do both if you don't mind.
All right, so I mean, I'll start with AI. When Dr. Asante and Dr. Mazama created the organization, they saw a clear need for our people to have political education along lines that are Pan-African, Afrocentric,
okay,
and Black nationalists. We saw political education as something that was lacking in our community. And I think Malcolm, I mean, we've said this for at least the last 100 years, that our people are politically immature. And as a result, we continue to get maneuvered and outmaneuvered by our opponents, right? Because when we think politics, oftentimes our politics go no further than voting or electoral politics. So, you know, we have seven objectives within the Constitution of Afrocentricity International. And the seventh or last objective is to influence all policy as it relates to African people, no matter where they may be. So by policy, I take the founders, Dr. Asante and Dr. Mazama, I take it that they meant legislation, laws that are put in place as it relates to African people, where African people are governed by these LA governments. So how did AI envision influencing policy? One way that I know that they sought to do so was through the Kete Asante Institute. So MKAI is actually the umbrella organization that Afrocentricity International sits under. And MKAI serves as an independent think tank within our community.
Okay.
And the purpose of this think tank is to do research and political analysis and produce white papers that could potentially influence the decision of lawmakers. So in that regard, I guess that's as far as I'm willing to speak, I guess, on behalf of AI, because that's what I know for sure.
Okay.
But where it comes from to me personally, and why I feel that there is still congruency in my personal political position and the political position of AI, is when I define politics. First and foremost, I am a person who is really solely concerned with the obtaining power. And politics for me is anything that we do to obtain power.
Okay.
Now, my critique, as you may know from, you know, the panel that I spoke on with you guys back in October, my critique of electoral politics or voting is I don't necessarily see it as an effective mechanism for us to gain power. And I think that at this point in the game, voting is somewhat short-sighted. And I say that for two reasons. One, the institutes that we are basically placing our faith in via the vote to serve as the arbiters of power, I believe that they are bankrupt and they are not an effective means by which we can obtain power. Because we've seen throughout time that the institutional racism of America is unyielding and uncompromising. And the end goal for those in power, and the end goal of the framers of the Constitution, was to bring about an America where its black population was either A, greatly diminished, or non-existent. I don't think that there is anything that we can do when it comes to voting to prevent that from happening. And I feel as though that plan is being carried out effectively. And currently where we are in our sojourn, I think that by us still continuing to vote and to go into the system to cast our votes, I think that it only weakens us. But I also think that it shows a lack of vision in terms of looking far enough down the road in terms of where we need to be as a people. Now, I would have no problem whatsoever with creating a government in waiting. Right, because mm-hmm. that's what I believe the UNIA was supposed to be. Marcus Garvey, he said, I looked around and I didn't see a government for the black man, so I said I would build one. Right, he said, where's the black man's government? So I built my own. Right, so he built a government and waiting that was supposed to be the entity that would come to power when black people actually actualized their sovereignty and actually built a nation on the African continent that was strong enough to protect the interests of African people everywhere. I'm not opposed to that, but actually continuing to engage in this system that is bankrupt, this system that only hears the voices of corporations and big dollars, I think that it's a losing game for us to engage in that road of politics, when I think that our politics could be much more broader and much more effective if we had the right type of consciousness, which I believe, our ancestor Malcolm X was speaking to in the clip that you played during the commercial break. You know, we talked about once we get the right type of consciousness, we don't have to be concerned about going to the local court or the national court or the federal court for them to be the arbiters of our power. We'll have the ability to bring it about on our own, because we will have achieved the necessary unity that is the prerequisite of true black power.
You know, I'm glad that you gave the organization's position and yours, because what you're saying, and especially in your position, is my sentiments exactly. To form political formations here as a quote-unquote government in waiting, because if things fell apart, I'll just use this as an example. If things fell apart tomorrow or next week for this country and the bottom fell out, we don't seem to understand politically how we should operate. We would set up things based off what we see here, which is full of graft, corruption, no ethics or European ethics, and that's not how we need to form. I think that's the right words, and I'm going to have to steal some of your phrases, Brother Omowale. It's a government in waiting. We need to learn, especially locally, where we control some of these tax monies that leave our neighborhood and go elsewhere. We need to perform a form small government in waiting and learn how to deal one with another, to spread the money around our communities. Because here at the Four, black folks pay taxes, especially locally, and the money goes straight out of our neighborhoods into center city areas, into other areas in our neighborhoods is lacking. And we have black faces over these communities. So,
And I think that it's important, especially for the audience, to understand what you're describing here is the neo-colonial reality of black America.
Okay.
Right, because one of the challenges is that due to our, I guess, lack of consciousness or political awareness, we, as black people in America, have failed to see ourselves as an internal colony in America. And because we don't understand the colonial dynamic, we find it difficult to come up with the proper analysis to explain how things work for us here in this society. Now, if we had the proper analysis and we understood that we were a colony, then we could look at how colonization works. For example, when the Europeans colonize a people, they always make that people finance their own colonization. And what do I mean by that? when we come in and take control over your land and take your resources, we then charge you what? A hut tax, right? So if you live on this land, you have to pay us a tax to administer the land. And how do you pay the tax? Well, you have to get a job. And how do you get a job? You come work within the colonial administration or one of the subsidiaries or subsidiaries or businesses that help to ensure the colonization continues to take place. You get a job working for them and you pay the tax to us. It's always been taxation without representation. However, when black people got fed up and said, you know what, we're tired of this white colonial governor taxing us and we're not getting anything, you know, we want to say in our own government. So the white people said, you know what, that's fine. Give us some time. And I'm paraphrasing here, but I'm telling you what they did. Mm-hmm. They will educate a class of people that we know will work in our interest, and those will be the black people that will govern you. And that's when you got the neo-colonial reality. So we saw that happen all across the African continent in the 60s, and we saw it being birthed here in America in the 70s, right? So you come out of the 60s here in America, go into the 70s, and we see an explosion in black political representation. However, it's colonial representation.
Yes.
They are managing the affairs of the colony, but not in the interest of the people who voted for them. They're managing it in the interest of the ownership class or the white class here in America. And I think that until we understand that, we'll think that, oh, I vote and they need to be doing something for me. Like, no, you are colonized. What are we going to do about this colonial situation and how we can overthrow it? That becomes the question. And until you're ready to deal with that, and when you deal with that, it connects you to colonial struggles all across the globe, but more specifically, the black colonial struggle. Because until black people do what Malcolm X said we need to do, recognize each, what that means when we get to the point where if somebody shoots my foot, I don't just look down and say, oh, well, it's just my foot. I don't care about that. You know, my head is in America. My hand is in Haiti. My leg is in the UK. And my foot is in Africa. So I don't care that they shot my foot, you know, because I'm not a body. I'm this, you know, this fragmented entity that the Europeans have created through the colonization and enslavement process.
If I can make this, because are you saying then through these, the Reclaim Your Heritage campaign and the expansion of consciousness, not that you're saying it, but you know, just the point of the project and the reason for the fund is by if our consciousness is expanded, we come to that conclusion as individuals and as a collective. That's one. And then the other, I don't know why I always have two questions, right? The other thing is, do you think that the issue of us, that we're willing to raise the money to expand our own consciousness?
Well, to answer the first question, so when we look at this project, the African Heritage and Cultural Preservation Fund, which is a fund, the money from the fund we're using to build institutions, I think that that's important, right? Because what we're ushering in here is another generation of institution builders. This is something that has been lacking, and as a result, black independent self-sustained institutions have greatly diminished since emancipation, to the point that the only independently operated institution that we currently have is right now is the black church and the black beauty salon and barbershop. And I'll put the black church in air quotes for reasons that I choose not to speak into right now. But the importance of these institutes, right? Now, let me give you an example. Right now, on the African continent, the Chinese government has already financed the development of 48 Confucius Institutes all over the African continent. Now, although it may not look like it on the surface, this is essentially a missionary enterprise, right? When the Europeans colonized Africa, it came in three waves. It came in what you refer to as the mercenaries, which is your military apparatus. After the mercenaries, you get the missionaries. And after the missionaries, you get the merchants, right? Now, the missionary enterprise was so ingenious, was once they created a mission church in a locality, slowly but surely, the influence of the Europeans would grow or emanate from around that space to the point that that space was fully conquered. What we're doing is taking that same model, but reversing it. Once we put an institute in a community, that institute then becomes a liberated zone, right? Where our people can then begin to claim their space on the land, right? Because a certain type of consciousness will grow from that reality, and that consciousness will create the conditions necessary for the people to operate as sovereign entities, right? But the only way for us to get there is A, to solve the economic question, the education question, right? Because consciousness is important, right? In many ways, this is a battle of the mind. And last but not least, the question of, well, you can call it religion, but it's really the question of spirituality, right? Reasserting or reaffirming our ancestors as key within our everyday life. Reasserting the practices that they passed down to us so that we can be sovereign people and operate based on certain principles and ethics. And that's what we're doing with these institutes. So everywhere we built one, and what you'll have eventually is you will have a network of liberated zones that can trade with one another, right? That can provide resources to one another by way of people or even finances or even other trades and things that we produce. But you don't get it without first developing an institutional apparatus that you can grow from. And that's what we're building with the Institute. And that's why this fund is so important, because this fund is our only way of building it. Now, I want you to bear in mind that if we look back to the – we've really only had one generation of institution builders since emancipation, and that was that generation that actually was born in slavery, but maybe they, like, for instance, Booker T. Washington was born in slavery, but he was freed at the age of 9. Now, in this generation, as a result of experiencing slavery, understood the importance of building institutions to safeguard their liberty, right? So in the immediate years coming out of slavery, we built institutions all over this country, from black banks to HBCUs. Now, although a significant amount of the HBCU money came from the Freedmen's Bureau, black people put up $750,000 of our own money. These are black people that worked, people who were soldiers in the Union Army. They put their savings up. They put their money where their mouth is to build the institutions. And this period of institution building saw its peak at about 1928 before we started to go in another direction. And slowly over the next 30 years, from about 1930 to 1960, we abandoned pretty much all of our independent black institutions in favor of integrating and finding our way into white institutions. And what you find today is a situation where we have no institutional power, and as a result, we have no economic or cultural power that we can wield and use against the system to get things to operate in our favor.
Let's grab a call or two, Richard. Let's go to Newport News. Newport News?
Newport News?
Good evening, gentlemen. Good evening, comrades.
How are you, sir?
I want to try to delve into something. I hear this brother talking. I understand you got a good command of the history, especially on education. I've been asking for the last 20 years when I see this charter school and voucher thing coming, how much money we're leaving on the table when what the white man is doing is going back to a states' rights kind of thing where the people get to determine exactly what the curriculum is in their schools and all of that. So I'm not understanding why, as taxpayers, we're stuck inside of this experiment called the United States. Why aren't we taking back some of our money to be able to control exactly what you're talking about? Educating our own students and our own children with our curriculum. It seems to me we're leaving a lot of money on the table running away from charter schools when they're already trying to defund the public schools. So some of our, if you look at the facts, because I know you're hip to education, for the last 30 years, a lot of really experienced black professionals have been thrown out of the public education system and actually retired thinking they're going to be doing good, and now the economy's all messed up, so they really don't have any employment. And I'm saying we should be taking back some of these federal dollars so we can set up the same institutions you're talking about, because they're trying to get away from any kind of control of what the curriculum is. So I'm saying we're leaving a lot of money on the table, unless I'm missing something. I'd like you to see if you could speak on that. Thank you.
Thank you for your call, Balu.
Yeah, I appreciate the question. What I would say is I would just be wary of, any hope that we put into, this pool of money at the federal level to fund our schools or to fund our institution building, because the reality is that pool of money at the federal level is actually a vanishing pool of money. And over the next, 20 to 30 years, it's going to really evaporate. What you saw, if you go back to about 1970, President Nixon at the time ushered in a period, and this was a knee-jerk reaction to the civil rights movement. He ushered in a period of neoliberalism, right? And I know this is a term that gets thrown around a lot. People always talk about neoliberal. But the best explanation that I've ever heard for what neoliberalism means is essentially privatization. And it's privatization of functions that should be public, right? So it's privatization of police. It's privatization of jails. It's privatization of education. It's privatization of government, to be frankly speaking, right? And this was a direct result of the civil rights movement, because as a result of the pressure that the civil rights movement brought to bear on this government was forced to give certain concessions, right? It was forced to give the Voting Rights Act. It was forced to give the Civil Rights Act. I think that there were three major acts that came out during that period. But the goal then became, okay, well, we need to remove the clause from the government. And clause, excuse my accent, I'm from Philly. I've heard that us in Philly, we have an accent sometimes. So when I say clause, I mean like bear claws, like the ability for something to do damage, like taking the teeth away. So they needed to take the teeth away from the government, because never again would they allow a movement to exercise so much power that the government then acts on behalf of that movement, even if the government acts in a way that leaves a floor trap, so anything they do will eventually be done away with over time. So what they did was, okay, let's do smaller government, let's do less taxation, let's make everything private. And you see that more and more today, to the point that you have a criminal justice reform that's pretty much ran by private individuals. Right now, I was just reading an article today about the immigrant situation down on the southern border, and I'm gonna make this apply to Black people, right? They have concentration camps right now that are in place to hold the children and the people who are being captured down at the southern border trying to make it into America. These concentration camps are being ran by private corporations. So what that essentially means is, at the time when Black people start to rise up in this country because we don't have access to resources and we want food and the government isn't doing anything for us, there will be private security situations put in place, and Black people will be ushered into privately owned corporate concentration camps. Another good example, recently there was over the past couple of months, there was a major fire out in California. Well, some of the rich white people got together, put their money together, and they hired a private fire department, right? Because the public fire department was so overwhelmed with all this fire that people said, listen, we need a private fire department to come in and just protect our property, right? So this is neoliberalism. This is privatization, and this is what we see occurring. So that pool of money that you think is going to be available that we can basically use our political power attack the government, so to speak, and get them to allow us to use that money to build our institutions, that money is going away quickly. And over the next 20 to 30 years, it's going to completely evaporate. And the fact that we don't have people right now preparing us for that reality, most of our people are preparing us for 2020. In 2020, we need to get out and vote. In 2020, we need to get to the polls. We don't have people right now that are preparing us for 2050 reality. And the reality is, The 2050 reality was prepared in 1850 by the white people. In 1850, they said in 2050, this is going to be the situation, and we're going to work diligently to make it to happen. Us, we're preparing every 4 years, every 2 years. We need to get out and vote. Nobody's thinking about what are things going to look like in 2080. And I think that if you are going to be a leader, or if you're going to have political vision, then that's where you need to be looking to. And for me, things like charter schools and things like that go off the table, because when you really have an honest conversation about the purpose of education in America, well, when the educational system was set up at the end of the 19th century, it was to provide people with the ability to work in the new factories. It's always been about go to school, get an education so you can get a job, right? So you can find your place in the economy. However, the economy is moving to a place where artificial intelligence and robotics will really take the role of labor. So then you have to ask the question, what are you being educated for? Are you being educated just to go into this economy to uphold their reality when, A, there won't even be a job in this economy? Or do you ask the question like Amos Wilson said, what does education truly need to be about? And what he said was for African children, our education needs to be revolutionary because we need to be educated to learn how to overthrow this system so we can build one that actually serves our interests. We don't need to be educated to go and work for Time Warner or go and work on Wall Street. And that's right now what even the African-centered schools and the chartered schools, that's what they're preparing our children for. Yeah, you're learning about your history while you're in these schools, but ultimately your job is to go and get your ultimate goal after you get this education is to find a place in this economy to continue to facilitate your own colonization. And we have to break that mode of operation.
Let's go to Brother Otis, Newport News, do you have?
Yeah, I wanted to try to, because I don't want to waste his time. What I want to try to delve into, and he actually hit on it early on, and I don't want to cut him off. I understand that this voucher system is going through a transition, and I don't want to eat up a lot of time because I'm going to tell you, I've studied it from Arizona all the way back to the East Coast, and I understand, I'm 65, I understand it's a regression back to exactly what was used in the 1950s to avoid segregation. The segregation academies all through the South were done for that. As a matter of fact, to give you a quick idea so you get where I'm going. The lady that was running for office and said that she would gladly attend a lynching if she were invited, she went to a segregation academy that started when I was a kid, and her child went there. So here's my point to you. I'm not saying rely on vouchers. What I'm saying is understanding that transition over time that you seem to have a good grasp at, we actually have a window of 10 to 12 years probably before it's honed down to getting rid of people, because right now most of these states, including Arizona, because I've studied them closely, actually reading the guidelines and the pitfalls in it, is set up so those vouchers follow the child. The difference is none of these charters are stuck with the same safeguards that public schools are. So I'm saying to you, I believe our people are leaving immediate money over the table to make this transition, because you're telling me you're running an Afrocentric schooling for your children, and if you're taking them out of public schools, it makes no sense to leave that money parked in a public school for another charter to take. That's what I'm saying. As a matter of fact, what I'd like to do is get some information to be able to catch up with you and maybe exchange some stuff over emails, because I had to literally learn No Child Left Behind as a single dad in a county I grew up in, York County, that's the heartbeat of this whole country's segregation and everything. I'm in Yorktown, Virginia, so I've seen that right across the water, 1710 Meritorious Manumission, the creation of race and stuff right here in the counties and the areas that I live in. I'm in a historical colonial Virginia. So I'd like to make sure I could catch up with you and maybe exchange some stuff over email so I can filter out what I might have gotten wrong.
Okay, that's no problem.
Okay, thank you. Thank you much, bro.
Thank you for your call, brother. You know, we're going to take a brief break, and when we come back, we'll continue the conversation with our special guest, Treasurer of the Philadelphia Chapter of Afrocentricity International and former president of the International Headquarters of Marcus Garvey, UNIA Chapter 121 here in Philadelphia. Brother Omawale Africa is with us. You can join the conversation by dialing 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. We'll be right back.
Listening to Time for an Awakening, Time for an Awakening, with host Brother Elliot and Brother Richard on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
I transformed a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one of the tangible transformations I've created for entrepreneurs in various industries around the country. If this isn't what you think of when you think of accounting and business consulting, then get ready to take down this invaluable information. Are you an entrepreneur suffering with a stagnating company? Have headache customers, staff, or vendors? Are you rebounding from a loss and need help achieving your unrealized potential? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? Hi, my name is Nataki Kanban. If you're ready to go beyond advising and coaching and get results, then call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions recommend and implement the best comprehensive sales, administrative, human resources, accounting, and operations to help you grow into your vision for yourself and your company. Again, from anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072 or pull us up on your device right now and book your free consultation at www.newbusinesssolutions.com. And just mention you heard this special announcement on Time for an Awakening.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
For 12 years, I and others like me have held out radiant promises of progress. I had preached to them about my dream. I had lectured to them about the not too distant day when they would have freedom all here now. I had urged them to have faith in America and in white society. Their hopes had soared. They were now booing me because they felt that we were unable to deliver on our promises. They were booing because we had urged them to have faith in people who had too often proved to be unfaithful. They were now hostile because they were watching the dream that they had so readily accepted turn into a frustrating nightmare. And so the collision course is set.
The desegregation decisions and other type of legislation and Supreme Court decisions depends upon changing the white man's mind. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad teaches us that our own mind has to be changed. We have to change our mind about ourselves.
In what way?
Well, so he teaches us the importance of moral reformation, a knowledge of self. And for instance, the average so-called Negro, he doesn't think that he can go into business and provide jobs for himself. And because of this, he thinks that he can only get a job from the white man, or he can only get clothes from the white man, or he can only get food from the white man. And we who follow the Honorable Elijah Muhammad are taught that the same thing that the white man has done for himself and his kind, if our people could be if we could be cured of our slave mentality that was indoctrinated into us during slavery, we would realize that just as the white man can do these things for himself and his kind, we can get together in unity and harmony and do the same thing for ourselves and our kind.
I'm not wondering at all about them. I'm concerned with the suffering and the pain of the masses of black people. No one wants to pay reparations. The Jews received over $100 billion in reparations and gets $4 billion annually. A Holocaust museum was set up for them on this soil for over $200 million, and they get $21 million annually just for operating expenses. But the Catholic Church, the Pope, the Jews, the Arabs, white people in general, no one wants to pay reparations to these, the sons and daughters of Africa. So I speak to them. I don't speak to the family of those two Jews. There are too many of us for me to speak to them.
And one of the reasons why I'm always happy to come to this organization, because you're the only one, you're the only black organization, again, that understands to put race first. Race first. Race first. And I've had some white folks to tell me that I was a flaming militant, a radical, or whatever all of these names were that they called me. And I said that I am very pleased that you called me a nationalist, because you could have said that I was a member of the NAACP or the Urban League. So I said, I'm very pleased of the names that you have given. But I said that because we put race first, something is wrong with us. But everybody else puts their own first, because God bless the child who has his own. And so I think that race first is very important. And though we meet in a different venue, we're not at the slave theater, we're not at the church, we're now at the Masonic Temple, it really does not matter where we are physically. It matters where we are in our minds. And wherever we meet, as long as we know that we're Africans and as long as we know that we are black people living here in America, we know exactly who we are. You notice you can put an Uncle Tom in any venue in the White House. You can even put him in his. He's going to still be a Tom. You can put him anywhere you want. Well, it's the same thing with us who are strong people. Wherever we are, we're going to be the people that we need to be.
Encourage, let me just say this before our time winds up, and that is, I want the people in the audience to go back and look at the video clip from Roots. It's entitled something like Breaking Kunta Kinte. That scene opens with Lorne Greene sitting in, who's the plantation master, sitting in his office, and then Fiddler comes in and says, we don't want to be too hard on the runaway. Kunta Kinte has just run away and been caught. And so the time comes for him to get his lashing. And if you look at this scene, it's about 9 minutes, and study the scene, study the role of everybody or bodies that are in this particular clip, and you will find that there is an equivalent role in the political life of our country today, whether it's on the national level or on the local level. There's the black man who actually does the whipping of Kunta Kinte. There's the white man who does the whipping. There's the black man who intervenes with the boss man and tries to save the life of Kunta Kinte. There's Kunta himself, who eventually is forced to admit that his name is Toby. And there's dozens of bystanders, black, who are watching. This is a very powerful scene. And it's an analogy of exactly what is happening in our community today. Let's give those characters names in our community and call them what they are, and then take care of business about that.
Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. We're in conversation with our special guest this evening, Treasurer of Philadelphia Chapter of Afrocentricity International. Brother Omowale Africa is with us in conversation. You can join the conversation too by dialing 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. Let's go back to the phones. Let's go to 215. Let's go to 215. Caller, what's your name? Where are you calling from? 215?
Yes. Hi. I'm calling from down in Florida.
Okay.
I wanted to ask, how can we donate and get involved in the fund that he was discussing, the AHGP fund?
Well, then, while you're still... Okay.
Yeah, I'm here. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can actually donate. If you go to the website, our website is www.reclaimyourheritage.fund, and that's .fund, F-U-N-D. We actually, when we launched the fund back on the 25th of November, we kicked off a 100-day challenge where we're looking for 1,000 people to make a symbolic contribution of $100 within the first 100 days. And this challenge was very unique because on the night that we actually launched...
Caller, turn your speaker volume down, please. Caller, turn your speaker volume down. Go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just saying on the night that we launched the fund, and you can check this out on the website, Dr. Amamazama actually issued a personal challenge to the entire community. And her challenge was for us to fund and build black institutions. And subsequent to her issuing that challenge, she actually donated $10,000 of her own personal money to the fund. So again, the goal within our first 100 days to build some momentum for the fund, we're looking to find 1,000 people to make a symbolic contribution of $100. But you can donate as little as $5 or as much as you like. You can even make recurring contributions, but we're encouraging everyone, definitely go to the website at reclaimyourheritage.fund and support the mission of what we're doing at the African Heritage and Cultural Preservation Fund.
All right. I guess my next question is how do you see the fund, or not the fund, rather, but the institution continuing forward after the first 100 days? What are the next goals and you know, how exactly does it move forward?
Oh, wow. So we actually have a lot planned. So within this first 100 days, this is like our early I guess, promo as it relates to the campaign and raising money specifically for the fund. But during the month of February, we'll be kicking off a campaign that we will be unveiling really, really soon. We're still currently working on the press release, but we have a campaign that we're going to have for Black History Month, because this will be a historic Black History Month with us commemorating 400 years of our sojourn on American soil. So we have a very unique campaign for that. But coming out of the first 100 days, we definitely will be allocating some of the funds to this first project. We have actually already purchased land in Abidjan, Ivory Coast, where we've, if you go to the page, to the website, there's a project gallery. And on the project gallery tab, you'll see some pictures of the land that we've already purchased in Abidjan, Ivory Coast, which is the economic center of the Ivory Coast. And the land that we've purchased, we've already erected, I don't want to call them buildings, but we've erected three structures so far on the land. But the money that we're currently raising for this particular project, right, for the Institute in Ivory Coast, is to erect the main institute, which will serve as the cultural hub, the economic hub, and the spiritual hub for that surrounding community. So what you'll have is you'll have a community of African people who, instead of going to the church, will be coming to the African Heritage and Cultural Preservation Institute. And this will be a place of commerce, of trade, of entrepreneurship, but also of education. So if you're donating to the fund, that is what you are contributing to. This is our first institute. But like I said, China has already built 48. So we have to surpass what China has done. But not only that, we want to build institutes throughout the diaspora as well. So we can encourage everyone to support and contribute.
Do you see some ways that we can help to get, particularly people in America, to really get behind this idea of institution building? Because I feel like, and I've been following you for a little while, and I've listened to you speak on different platforms, and I think people, the question, and you touched up on it a little bit earlier regarding, you know, the descendants of slaves and things like that. But is there any way to get the African-American population a little bit more behind and really more understand the purpose of an institution, right? Like, I don't think people understand that that's a body that has to operate. And then you need the physical location of an institute to facilitate the functions of the institution. But if people don't see it in front of their face here in America or down the block on their street, it doesn't seem to resonate with them. So in what ways do you think we can sort of galvanize the population here in the diaspora to get behind what needs to start on the continent and then, you know, obviously spread as this institution, this organizing body, continues to move forward?
Yeah, what I would say, you know, this again becomes another educational effort. One thing that I try to tell people whenever I'm speaking to them and they ask the question, why are we starting in Africa? You know, why not start right here? And the way that I answer that question is, as a Garbyite, we always have to have a stake in the game as it relates to the African continent. And as of right now, there is no international organization, at least that I know of, that currently has a significant stake in the ground on the African continent that where we could go and build. And the reason why this is important is because every nation across the globe right now is betting their future on Africa, right? So you see that this modern day rush to recolonize, or this modern day scramble for African resources, and no nation is sitting to the side, right? So America is betting her future on Africa. Meanwhile, Black people in America are betting our future on America, right? And for America, in order for her to maintain her dominance, she needs to ensure that Africa, and by extension, African people, including Black people in America, remain subjugated for the next four centuries.
Yes.
Because the moment that Africa is not subjugated, the moment that that status quo or that paradigm changes, then it changes the power paradigm globally, and America doesn't want that. So I think that that's why we need to have a say in what's going on in the African continent and why we all need to be involved in making it come to fruition.
And I guess my last question would be, what do you foresee being, like you just said, you know, once they want to keep the population, the black population subjugated, the African population subjugated, whether it's on the continent or in the diaspora. So as this institution is growing and all of these institutes are being erected, what do you foresee happening once they begin to catch on to that happening and that vehicle sort of, you know, moving in a direction that is in direct conflict with their aims and their goals? What do you foresee happening? I know you mentioned talking about planning for how we plan only for a few years ahead, you know, 4 years ahead, the following weekend, you know, tomorrow. How do we see this in the future, in the next 20, 30, 50 years as these institutions are building? Can we even sustain them? Can we protect them?
Yeah, I actually see these institutions flourishing. And the reason why that is when we look to the continent right now, currently there are no alternatives to neocolonial programs, either at the, you know, national or the state level or country level or at the local level. Right down on the African continent, what you have is youth programs or youth movements that are attached to secular or Western governments. For example, Barack Obama, one of his major contributions to the continued colonization and subjugation of Africa was the creation of YALI. YALI is an acronym. It stands for the Young African Leadership Initiative. And the goal of this program is for them to identify young African people at the grassroots level that they can train up to essentially operate at the grassroots level in the interests of America.
Yes.
And as these young people gain power at the grassroots level, initially they will rise to the actual halls of power and ensure that the government remains a government that is friendly to American interests. Right now, there is no alternative to that. You know, every youth program across the African continent throughout the diaspora is a program that's geared in that direction. So when young people see something that's actually grassroots, something that's actually race first, that teaches them what Pan-Africanism is, what Black nationalism is, what it means to be Afrocentric, our people are going to flock to that, especially when they see the success of it, because nothing succeeds like success. And when we show them that we're capable of building our own self-sustaining institutions, our people will come, they will support them, and they will grow.
Absolutely, absolutely. I want to thank you for sharing the information, and thank you for the work that you're doing.
Caller.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Thank you for your contribution. You know, Rollo Mawali, you mentioned about that organization that Barack Obama started on the continent, and he started something similar here with young black people that they're targeting. What's that called, Richard? Is it the Brothers Keep? Brothers Keeper.
Brothers Keeper.
Yeah. So it's a lot of things. Oh man, you're hitting on a lot of good points this evening. And let me say something in reference to the institution building, because one of the programs that we have on Time for Awakening, Black Reality Think Tank with Dr. William Rogers, talks about the need for institution building, because a lot of the historians, and I'm talking on the white side, white historians, a lot of their research and things of that nature are always tied to institutions. And heretofore, we don't have that. Some of the quote-unquote black historians, some of the ones that are accepted by white society, I'm not talking about the ones on that, you know, that we look to, are tied to white institutions. Gates and a few others are tied to white institutions. Their research is tied to white institutions. But I understand exactly what you're saying, Brother Omwali. And, you know, one of the other things that I want to mention in reference to what is being conducted by Afrocentricity International. I remember when Dr. Asante used to go to Belize and Colombia and other places and start classrooms without walls, for lack of a better term. He put me in touch, Dr. Asante, with a brother in Colombia. He was on the program about 4 years ago. And I stay in constant contact with him because he always reaches out to me, lets me know what he's doing, you know, things that he has learned since he's been involved with knowing himself and with the help of Dr. Santi. So I can see firsthand some of the work that's being done internationally with the organization. So I just want to mention that to you because I don't know whether you was even aware of that.
No, I wasn't. But, you know, Dr. Asante is our international organizer for a reason, because he travels and lectures so extensively. And whenever, wherever he goes, people are always asking, well, how can they learn more or how can they get involved? And he always pitches the organization. So as a result of that, we have people reaching out to us from, I think we had somebody reach out to us from Russia, you know, wanting to start a chapter of Afrocentricity International. So internationally, you know, we're growing quickly. It's just here in America, our pace is a bit slower, but I think that 2019, we are going to see a turn of the tide. And I'm looking forward to doing my part to help ensure that we have chapters all over America from 2019 and beyond.
Let's go to, we got two calls from home. Let's go to BTR. BTR.
Hey, what's up, Brother Elliot and the guests?
How are you, sir?
Hey, I'm doing okay. I was hearing the young man talk about YELE, the leadership program for young people on the continent of Africa. And, you know, they're doing the same thing here in the United States. That's all I wanted to share. You know, the Obama Foundation announced earlier this year that, you know, they were providing applications for, quote unquote, community leadership training. and I, you know, like your last program, well, the last program that I heard and, you know, where we were discussing Michelle Obama throwing Reverend Jeremiah right under the bus, and not just Reverend Jeremiah right under the bus, but our elders, you know, and basically saying they just cranky because of what they lived through, you know, in segregation. And so, you know, that goes to show you that should be a hint as to how they're going to be training up these young people in the United States and what have you. So I just wanted to share that they're doing the same thing here in the United States.
I appreciate you for sharing that, brother. I've definitely been paying attention because, you know, this has been for some time now. You know, the creation of this puppet neo-colonial, very charismatic leadership, conservative and neo-colonial foundations have been at work for quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, Dr. Adolf Reed wrote in the Village Voice, I believe this was back in 1996 when Barack Obama got elected as a junior senator. Before we even knew him on the national stage, he was very critical. He said that this new senator represents the new crop of foundation-hatched politicians that are essentially, you know, going to serve the interests of, you know, of white supremacy. And Barack Obama was the perfection of that. And now that Barack Obama, they've seen the success of this one particular Manchurian candidate, they have now have Barack Obama through his foundation churning out millions of these types of people that are going to serve the interests of white supremacy.
Yeah, you see he's been mentoring, what's the guy's name that lost down there? Gilliam. He's been say that again, I'm sorry.
No, I was agreeing with you.
Oh, yeah, he's been mentoring several of these folks. So you see, hey, I agree wholeheartedly exactly what you're saying.
I just would add, though, and it goes to the point of the institution building versus the populace. The revolutionary populist movement that is occurring within the Black world amongst young people, amongst us in, at this moment. And the thing is that I see is that we see in different countries that a young population that is outside of these here made neo-colonial or colonial institutions that are trying to make new neo-colonial candidates, that there's a young population that is organizing as yourself in these communities that are leading populist movements, but are not necessarily have institutional support, or there is no institution. So we have a disconnect in which we have to be watchful for, because on one level, that is going on, and then at another level, and I'm not sure whether it's a good thing or not, but you know, what the continent is doing, what the African leadership is doing out of the AU, even in talking about cross-border opening, that continental arrangement, even if they are selling these projects to China and America and others, they are giving signs of looking out for their self-interest. It seems they're over a long haul, because once those African states actually start trading amongst themselves and creating, and as the brother from Ghana said, recognizing that their young people are their primary resource that they must capture and maintain within their country, within their own countries, within the continent, in order to be able to compete with these other countries, whether that be China, whether it be Europe, or whether that be America. That's a sign that comes out of the resistance movement that you talked about earlier of the 50s, the 40s and 50s. So I see at that level, state level, something going on, but definitely at the populist level. And what we don't have is what Afrocentricity International and this fund is talking about doing is an institutional building process in order to have a place so that they can come to, or what you call free space.
Yeah.
Let's go to...
No, you sound like you wanted to go to another caller.
No, go ahead. Go ahead. Finish your thought.
Okay, no. I was going to say... you know, I definitely agree with your assessment in terms of like the lack of institution building among these populist movements. However, I am very critical of many of the populist movements that I see rising up on the African continent. I am afraid that on the top, the rhetoric in many instances sounds very good. But beneath it, it's reminiscent of the misdirection that happened to our young people coming out of the 60s, going into the 70s, right, where people like Dr. Bobby Wright would say, you know, the Panthers left the struggle for race and entered to the struggle for class and ass.
Mm-hmm.
I look at the character of many of these populist movements. I see that similar mistake being made. But even with far greater deviations away from race into more, LGBT, trans, and this is really the character of like these youth populist movements. For example, if we look down at South Africa with Julius Malema, you know, the EFF, they recently had a manifesto update, you know, where they sat down with the trans and LGBT community to ensure that, you know, the future South Africa that they envisioned was also incorporated into their manifesto. And for me, when I look at that, it lets me know that ideologically, we still don't have the clarity that we need to overthrow white supremacy. So as a result, we're continuing to repeat the same mistakes that have been made by prior generations. And I think that that's the importance of Afrocentricity International and giving people that ideological clarity so that we can operate in a manner that ultimately brings about our true liberation and sovereignty.
Let's go to 602. 602.
Yes. Good brothers, Brother Elliot, Brother Richard, and Brother Uomale Akota, Brother Marcus.
How are you, sir?
I'm doing great, good brothers. I'm doing great. You know, the brother started and he spoke about Zambia. You know, and that's all the American educational system produces, Zambia. You know, brain dead black people. But, you know, when you said about the AU and the AU leadership, youth leadership, they got a group of toms that they are grooming. Man, I'm telling you. I mean, I never seen a bunch of bootlickers like that in my life. You know, I swear. I was on a platform with them, and I had to leave for my sanity. That's how crazy they were, you know? I mean, you expounding black nationalism, and they attack you. So I was, man, I had to get out of there, pick fast in a hurry, because I said, for my sanity, I had to go. But unlike what the young brother, and what this organization is talking about, I would like the brother to speak a little bit more about the economic side, because I would definitely like to work with the brothers and that organization, because we are doing something in Africa with cashew crop. And that is one product that we can literally take over and help to move us up economically as a people, because we own the supply. We control that market. See, we have the supply in Africa. So I have a program. I say, I have ample supply of people on the continent. The supply is the same problem that the brother expounded. Here is the problem. It's getting this Negro here to say, look, you could benefit from joining with your brother and your sister on the continent. You know, and I like how they got this set up in Abidjan, because Ivory Coast is one of the biggest suppliers of cashew nuts. You see? And that economy, we could take it over overnight. You know? So if the brother could expound a little bit more on the economic business aspect, and, you know, because we know that we can't just alone to depend on black folks to fund it. We're going to have businesses where we generate income, where we can finance it ourselves. And I'll just listen to what the brother, I'll mute my phone and listen to what the brother has to say based on the economics. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
I wanted to be clear. Did you say cash for the markets?
Yes. Cash or not. That is something we can take. You get more returns than gold. If the return on that little nut is 10, you know, 1,000% return, and we could take over that economy, because we're talking about control. We're going to have to take over our natural resources. This is one resource we can start moving to take over. And I'll mute my phone and hear the brother.
Thank you, sir.
No, I appreciate the question from the caller, and I definitely appreciate him reiterating the fact that this crop of leadership that they are raising up in Africa is probably like the greatest crop of bootlickers that we have ever seen to date, which is why I'm very, very critical, especially of the so-called youth movements on the continent, because even the ones that sound radical or revolutionary and their rhetoric, you know, when you scratch beneath the surface, it's just more confusion. But to answer the brother's question about the economics, we are very focused on creating the conditions necessary for African spirituality to thrive. And in order for it to thrive, it's going to take an institutional effort to re-educate and re-socialize our people. In order for these institutions to be put in place, they have to be self-sustained. So that's where the economics comes in at. So when we're talking about a self-sustaining mission or a self-sustaining institute, there's a two-pronged approach to the way that we're going about it. The first is through agriculture. And if you Google, there's a center in Benin right now. It's called the Songhai Center. It's spelled Songhai Center, C-E-N-T-R-E. It's spelled, you know, with the British spelling.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what they've done at the Songhai Center is they've created a self-sustaining agricultural model where the people of that community are producing the things that they consume. But beyond even the agriculture, they've created hotel and restaurant businesses where they're selling products, and they've actually built an economy. But it started based upon agriculture, right? Because like Thomas Sankara told us, he who feeds you controls you, right? So we're trying to prevent economic coercion from occurring. And the way that it occurs is by somebody controlling you economically. So if we can create the conditions where you can feed yourself, but you can also have the foundation of what an economy needs to grow, that's part A. So that's our first attempt. Our first attempt is basically based upon agriculture. And the beauty of agriculture is even here in America right now, there's a growing urban agriculture movement. So the issues of land and water and food can be tied in all across the diaspora with the issues of that of the African continent. Then the second way that we are approaching this is what we refer to as microfinance or microlending. Now, this is something that NGOs, meaning non-government organizations, have been doing for about the last 10 years. They do it in India. They do it in places in like all throughout Africa in the village. And the way that they do microfinancing or microlending, the goal is to, at least for these NGOs, they target the woman because they believe that if they make these loans available to women, then it will help to, you know, balance out the gender inequality. But the reality is what they're really trying to do is create a condition similar to the condition they created in America, where you have an unemployed population of men and an employed population of women, and slowly but surely you can start to control the population that way, right? But what we're doing, when we adopt micro-lending, we'll do the same thing, where so we'll make, you know, a $20, a $50, a $100 small loan available. Now, this amount of money goes a far way as startup capital for people in these parts of the world to enter the local economy or the local market to make a living, to provide for and support a family. Now, in this small business creation, what it will do is it will spur a local economy where trade can occur. But in addition to that, through the institute, they can get entrepreneurship training, which will assist with the small business growth and development. So everything that we are doing is geared around the self-sustainment of the institute, because the institute will be the vehicle by which consciousness is transformed. And subsequently, the surrounding community is transformed. And the more and more of these institutes we create, the more consciousness we spread and we grow our footprint. And that's how we that's the part we play in helping us to obtain our liberation, right? Because we adamantly believe that our people will not be restored without a return to African spirituality. And we're trying to create the conditions so that that can be a reality. So I hope that answers
the
question.
Brother Omwali, what are some of the challenges that you see or might envision or have run into in raising money in our community?
The biggest challenge that we have right now, specifically in America, because it's not about Black people don't mind giving money.
I know that. Yeah, you're right. Go ahead.
There was a report on charitable giving came out in 2017, and one of the findings in this report was that Black people give at four times the rate of white people, right? So we have a culture of giving in the Black community, but what we have also is a crisis in legitimacy, right? And what I mean by that is, almost anybody can get on YouTube and all types of charlatans can raise lots and lots of money from the community and then don't fulfill the promises. And what you do when you do that is you erode the trust of the community. So now when someone else comes around to try to raise money, they look like, oh, well, this must be a scam just like the other thing was, because the last person that I gave money to didn't fulfill their promise, so I'm not going to give money to this person, right? So that really is the biggest challenge. And for us, I think that we have to be understanding of that reality, and we have to work to earn our people's trust. I don't think that that the people should just give their trust over or just give their money over when people haven't proven to be good stewards of their resources. But for us, I think that we are operating based on principles of integrity, based on principles of transparency. So slowly but surely, we will create the momentum necessary where people feel more comfortable giving us money. We tried to even do that with the website, right? We didn't go and create a GoFundMe page. We invested in having a website created that can provide people with information, a website that is professional, a website that is secure, so you don't have to worry about, your information being stolen or anything like that. Like, we've thought about all these things up front, but again, it's going to take some time to establish trust. But the longer Afrocentricity International is in the community, and the more we do to serve the community, the more people will, begin to trust us, and people will begin to give and support our efforts.
Let's go to let's go across the Atlantic to the UK. Brother Paul, are you there? Are you there? Let's put him back on hold. Brother Omwali, because I want to try to get him on. He's been waiting a while. This is what we'll do. You all right, Richard?
Yeah.
Good. We'll take a brief break, and when we come back, we'll continue the conversation. A couple more things I want to discuss with throughout the Brother Omwali, and then we'll get him to reiterate the website and how people can get. In fact, before we break for a commercial, go ahead and give that information out, and then we'll come back and continue the discussion. Go ahead, Brother Omwali.
Yeah, the website is www.reclaimyourheritage.fund. That's www.reclaimyourheritage.fund. If you'd like to get in touch with me, there is a get in touch tab on the website. So just definitely fill it out. Somebody or myself will be back in contact with you within 24 hours. But definitely we encourage you to donate. Brother Rich, we'd like to thank you because you were one of those people early on who made that symbolic donation of $100, because we're looking for 1,000 people in the first 100 days to give a symbolic contribution of $100. But if you can't do that, feel free to give as little as you would like or as much as you would like. And you can even give recurring contributions. So thanks in advance for the support.
And we'll be right back. You can join the conversation by dialing 215-490-98. 32, that's 215-490-9832. We'll be right back with our guest.
Listening to Time for an Awakening, Time for an Awakening, with host Brother Elliot and Brother Richard on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
I transformed a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one of the tangible transformations I've created for entrepreneurs in various industries around the country. If this isn't what you think of when you think of accounting and business consulting, then get ready to take down this invaluable information. Are you an entrepreneur suffering with a stagnating company? Have headache customers, staff, or vendors? Are you rebounding from a loss and need help achieving your unrealized potential? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? Hi, my name is Nataki Kanban. If you're ready to go beyond advising and coaching and get results, then call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions recommend and implement the best comprehensive sales, administrative, human resources, accounting, and operations to help you grow into your vision for yourself and your company. Again, from anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072 or pull us up on your device right now and book your free consultation at www.newbusinesssolutions.com. And just mention you heard this special announcement on Time for an Awakening.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
I must be measured by my soul. The mind is the standard of the man. With this new sense of dignity and this new sense of self-respect, a new Negro came into being with a new determination to suffer, to struggle, to sacrifice, and even to die if necessary in order to be free.
Hang on to the world as it spins around.
All our people. Righteous by nature, wicked by circumstance, so we are going to try to save our people. Take control of our communities. Anybody that wants justice, come out of those parties that won't give you justice, and let's have a justice party and set up our own candidates, run them in the cities. Take down the weak, blood suckers of the poor, and cast them out, and set up people that will fight for justice for us.
Because there's a whole lot of illusions about Africa's relationship with other people in the world. There's a whole lot of illusions about our relationship to the religions in the world. And these belief systems that had its origin in Africa, all of them, and there is no exception, turned on African people. I said there is no exception. And there's one thing you have to get through your mind and keep it. Nothing that ever came from the European mind was meant to do anything but facilitate European domination of the world. And I said, there's no exception. Everything that was brought into this continent, everything, every idea, every so-called religion, was meant to dominate and to control. The Arabs had no illusions about it. The Europeans had no illusions about it. You were the ones with the illusions. And yet every element that went into the making of every major religion in the world started in Africa. Why is it that you are so naive? You let people redress something that you invented, sell it back to you, and enslave you through it.
if we are to defeat the European, if we are to master this earth and take back this earth from the European, then we must outthink the European. We must then be creative. That puts the learning emphasis on the how-ness, the how to think as such, and to the use of knowledge as a tool of mastery. So it's a very different kind of thing. As a result, you see, the control and the paternalism of Europeans over black people. You see, the other thing that we must recognize, even if the European becomes good and nice and accepts us and so forth, the fact that he would still be in control creates a what we might call a benevolent paternalism, which still to a great degree helps to maintain this passive mode of thinking and this passive mode of knowledge.
Welcome back to Time for an Awakening, and we're in conversation this evening with our special guest, Treasurer of Philadelphia Chapter of Afrocentricity International, Brother Omar Wally. Africa is with us in conversation. You can get involved in the conversation, too, with the time we have left by dialing 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. Brother Omar Wally?
I'm here.
Question I want to ask you about our people and their relationship to the continent. But first, I want to it's a passage, a couple of paragraphs or a passage or two that caught my eye in the book of Dust of Dawn by W.B. Du Bois in the chapter Revolution, and he talked about his three things that he really wanted to accomplish in his life.
Yeah, the Pan-African Congress, the cooperative economics, and the education initiatives.
Yes. And he talked about his relationship in the NAACP and when he was there. Two things kind of jumped out at me because we're dealing with the same thing now, and they don't change necessarily their playbook. They might change some plays, but they don't change the playbook necessarily. They use the same thing against us constantly. I just want to read just a couple of sentences on what he said about the NAACP, because, you know, he was talking about his envision of a Pan-African Congress to attack some of these issues that we had been facing internationally.
Mm-hmm.
He said, "I found that the board of directors of the NAACP were not particularly interested. The older white liberals among them did not envision Africa or the colored peoples of the world." Then he said, "There too were colored members who had inherent and fierce repugnance toward anything African. Beyond this, they felt themselves American, not Africans. They resented and feared coupling anything with Africa." That mindset is still here among our people. Some of them hide it a little bit more than others, but I think the basis of that mindset is still there, which is even more dangerous now because of the environment that we live in and the times that we're living in. Two questions. What do you say to people that don't consider themselves African or don't want to do anything as far as going back to the continent, developing a relationship with the continent? How do you answer those people? And number two, and it might be related to this question and it might not, how do we come up with strategies to protect ourselves from people of that other mindset? Because they can become dangerous to any movement, progressive movement. They're potential enemies and spies. How do we come up with strategies to protect ourselves from that? And you can just go into it cursory. You don't have to go into detail. But just talk about that. The first one, especially.
That is a... Oh, for those are some difficult questions to answer. First and foremost, let me just say that W.E.B. Du Bois' Dusk of Dawn, specifically his chapter Revolution, is one of the most important reads
if you consider yourself a revolutionary, if you consider yourself doing work to liberate African people, because a lot of these strategies that we try to rehash, you know, you'll see that Du Bois reached, you know, several conclusions. And if you realize why he reached those conclusions, you won't be trying to implement those same strategies today.
Exactly. You know, let me say something before you answer. Just put a pin in what you're saying, because I want you to answer the questions. Take time doing it. But, you know, the blueprints for what we need to do, our ancestors have left the blueprints. We don't need to reinvent the wheel. This book, and especially that chapter that you're talking about, other books by some of our elders, some of the messages left by some of our elders that have went on, even in some of those little clips and vignettes that I play with music behind it, the blueprints and strategies are left by some of our ancestors. We just have to look back at history, take their words, and put them into action and understand the mistakes and pitfalls that they made. He talks about it in that chapter that you're talking about. But go ahead. I want to let you go into it.
I won't go into heavy detail in as it relates to Du Bois, because I touch on Du Bois a great deal. I do a lot of reading on as it relates to Du Bois,
okay,
specifically that text that you're referring to. But to answer your question about this denial of Africanness, Du Bois used to have a concept that he laid out early on called double consciousness. And what that essentially means is that, you know, you see, or we as Black people looking at ourselves through the lens of white people. You know what I mean? This is what, you know, Dr. Amos Wilson would talk about when he used to say we got to be insane, you know, or we got to have some type of foreign spirit operating inside of us for us to exist the way that we do. We got to be out of our minds. And this double consciousness, that's exactly what it means. It means that you're out of your mind, because you are literally stepping out of yourself to look at yourself through the lens of somebody else. So this is why we reject being African, because the European has so denigrated Africa and so denigrated Blackness that you don't want anything to do with it. You know what I mean? I wrote a post one time on social media talking about how our self-hate is at the root of all of our division and how it plays out on many different ways. You know what I mean? So when we're rejecting Africa, what we're essentially doing is rejecting ourselves, right? Malcolm used to say that you can't hate the root of the tree without actually hating the tree. Likewise, you can't hate Africa without hating yourself. You know what I mean? So our people that reject Africa are essentially rejecting themselves. And in that regard, I don't know if there's anything that can be said or done to change that type of mindset if somebody isn't ready to change it. And to answer the second part of your question in terms of how do we fortify ourselves against such incursions, I think that it's challenging because, all of us to one degree or another have an element of the European within us.
Yes.
You know what I mean? And it always rears its head. It's oftentimes the cause of the egocentric, you know, bouts that we have that tear down our organizations and tear down our relationships, right? Because that's there. I think that we have to be honest and we have to acknowledge that it's there. But that process of exercising it, you know, what does that look like? You know what I mean? And I think if we examine Du Bois' life, I would say Du Bois' entire life has been a process of him looking to exercise that second consciousness within him. You know, and the symbology of his life is that even if he never got it completely right, he died in Africa, right? So his entire life was him running away from Europe, or away from Eurocentric ideals and running back towards Africa, right? There was a message for us in his life, not just in his writings, but in the way he lived his life and how he ended it. Not ended it, but where he ended it.
Okay.
So in terms of, I don't know, in terms of protecting ourselves, brother, it's going to be tough. You know, I think for that reason, you know,
the core of the thrust of our movement has to be spiritual for that reason. Our movement has to be one that is meant to morally and spiritually reform the African identity. But even when you study historically, you know, moral reformation movements, the most popular one that we know, or at least the mythology, you know, whether you believe it or not, is that of Christ. And I think the great example in that particular story is that there's always going to be a Judas amongst you. So, I mean, you can prepare for it, but at the end of the day, I think that what's fated is what's fated. But you can still take your precautions to try to protect yourself and the organization from being infiltrated by that mindset, or at least mitigate the amount of damage it can do when it does appear.
You know, I asked that question to the chairman, Fred Hampton Jr., here when we were reflecting on his dad and what the United States government, along with the FBI and Chicago police, did to him and his organizations now and his activism and how, you know, that I asked that same question. And he said, well, with the organization they have now, they continue working. Do you remember, Richard, when he said they work all the time? And he said if the people ain't working, then they make themselves suspect. So he kind of filters them out through constantly working, putting new projects out there, and they're working. So that was his answer, which I thought was pretty good.
That's a brilliant answer. And I think I would answer along the same lines. I think that you have to create the conditions where people single themselves out, whether mm-hmm. it be a code of conduct, you know what I mean? Whatever it is, you got to create the conditions where people kind of single themselves out. But even with that, you know, you're still not going to catch everything. You know, are going to be infiltrated. But, like, that comes with the territory. You don't, you know, what Frederick Douglass said, that power concedes nothing without a struggle. So you think that you're going to build an organization to overthrow a system that's deeply entrenched that wants to maintain the status quo without that system looking to fight back? I think that that's a fairy tale. So I think we got to understand that, you know, we are going to be infiltrated and they are going to fight back. But that doesn't mean that we give up, you know, because, you know, unity is our aim, right? And victory is our destiny. We're operating from a consciousness of victory. So we always say we will win. You know, that's the bottom line.
Go ahead, Richard.
No, I was just, I the thought I have in trying to, as I reflect on your question, Elliot, and the answer, because I think that it's something that we're kind of working towards. But the, you know, the core of building institutions and having institutional relationship, pushing it further as far as just for term and language, having institutional trade. Afrocentricity is asking, you know, for support in order to be able to build an institution that has a particular purpose. And there's other African, we call them African-centered or African-conscious institutions that are in existence. What we have to do, I mean, talking about, you know, first line of protection, is being able to create a mechanism where we're trading with each other. Just imagine 1,000 already small, fledgling African-centered institutions providing Afrocentricity with $100. Already they have met their goal, and what it has done is that reinforce institution-to-institution relationship. The question I ask in proposing that thought is that, do we have that mechanism now? Maybe you gentlemen can correct me, but I would say not. And the closest that we did come to it was when the Black United Fund, as a way of getting money, and as you say, Brother Mulally, developing trust. Black United Fund was established to be able to bring together institutions, and it was the corner, the center structure that redistributed contributions that people selected. But people recognized that institute trusted that institution would provide the money to them. And that institution was attacked. I mean, even here in Philly, the local, I mean, just in supporting Mumia, it was one of the breaking points of that institution.
It was the breaking point.
It was an institution of institutions. Am I right? And so that to me, when we're talking about politics, we're talking about, even our spirituality, and we're talking about a defense. If those of us who recognize ourselves as in this here, having this victory of consciousness, can be able to create large or small trade relationships with each other, create a, we'll go back to the 19th century, they had conventions. We came up to the 20th century, the closest we came to that kind of convention process was in 72 in Gary. This is in North America. And it broke down because of what you gentlemen were saying. But it's for me to fight that, we would have to, those who really claim that they're African-centered, that test that, that was raised in relationship by, the work and providing more work, that would be the first step. Us being able to, I'll call it a trade with each other. Because when you trade with each other, you create a relationship with each other. And if you break that, then it's clear that what you broke. But for us African-centered, wanting to build institutions or claim we already are institutions or are working towards the development of African people, if we're not together, aren't we perpetuating the same thing we're saying and demonstrating what Dr. Du Bois was saying about that double consciousness, whether it be as an institutional level or as an individual level? That is that we're more individualistically driven than collectively driven, which is a part of our cultural value to be collective, right? I kind of react to that because that's what I'm looking for as a means of that solution, is that these institutions, Afrocentricity International, supporting other with, just supporting that effort, like it already has an effort in, what was the country you said?
Abidjan.
It already has the formation of land. Brother Marcus mentioned another place. We're people who've been working to develop these networks. Why haven't we been able to create our own old African unity conference and do the diplomatic relationship, do the trade relationship, where spirituality is a part of that, but it's also reinforcing the trust and showing that we're working not individually, but working together. That's what I'm looking at.
Yeah. I Brother Rich, you already know that I agree with you on that regard. And we talk quite frequently about the importance of relationships and establishing relationships in order to build trust. I think one of the biggest challenges as it relates to creating these institutional relationships is, A, we don't even have singular thriving institutions in the community. And for some reason, many of these institutions continue to get kind of like trapped in the mire of, I don't want to call it being like egocentric, but not willing to work with one another, right? So in order to overcome that, I think that Dr. Asante was very clear in creating this organization, that they saw Afrocentricity International as a vanguard organization, right? They recognized very early on that, we may not reach mass movement status like Garvey reached, where he had 11 million members in the organization, but that doesn't mean that we can't be a mass-based network, meaning that we have chapters everywhere that may consist of 30 to 40 people that are operating and getting things done. And that's the space that we are looking to stand in and operate in. It's more of a guerrilla warfare type strategy, moving, staying small, staying nimble, staying agile, but getting things done, moving very fast at the front of the pack. And that's kind of like how we foresee ourselves operating in this movement towards Black liberation, And as I think we get wins and those wins build on one another, I think that it'll create opportunities
for other organizations to see what we've done and implement it. And then they too, we'd be able to you know, work side by side with them. And one of the great things about what we're doing specifically with us being an international organization like, you know, Garvey's UNIA, is oftentimes we have people who have local initiatives that are already successful, but those initiatives aren't tapped into similar initiatives that are occurring in other localities. What we offer as a global organization is a way for those people to come and get tapped in to a national, international organization, and then coordinate efforts with other like-minded people. And we're seeing that more and more with people reaching out to us from all across the globe, saying, hey, I already have this thing going on in my area, but I would like to collaborate with you guys to work together. How can we do that? And that's a conversation that we're always open to entertain, assuming consciously we're moving in the same direction, right? Because like Dr. Santi always says, consciousness precedes unity. So,
Brother Owen Wally, listen, I want to thank you for being with us. You know the door is always open to you. Anytime you want to come on, talk about some issues, talk about what the organization is doing, the door is always open. But before you go, give out the information again, how people can reach you if they want to join the organization, get more information, your social media outlets, anything you want to give, the floor is yours. Go ahead.
Thanks again, Brother Elliot and Brother Rich, for having me on the show tonight to discuss our organization, Afrocentricity International, and the African Heritage and Cultural Preservation Fund. If people want to contact me, they can definitely reach out, connect with me on Twitter. Just at me. I definitely see all my @s, so at me at Omowale Africa on Twitter. Or feel free to just get in touch by visiting the website, reclaimyourheritage.fund. Once again, it's reclaimyourheritage.fund, F-U-N-D. We are in the middle or at the beginning of a 100-day campaign where we're looking to get 1,000 people to give a symbolic contribution of $100 within the first 100 days. So thank you to everyone who has already contributed, and thank you to everyone who's looking to support.
If you send me something, maybe a bulletin or something like that, I'll post it on the Time for Awakening website.
Okay. I'll send that to you this evening.
Thank you, sir. We'll talk soon.
All right. Peace. All right.
Take care now, brother.
Peace. Richard, interesting conversation with Brother Omowale. Young brother that's out here doing yeoman work in the area and moving it towards the international stage. Talking about institution building with a relatively young man in his early 30s. You're talking about something as a recipe for success with other minds similar to his. It can be nothing but successful.
Yes,
definitely. You know what, Richard? I don't know whether I ever told you. You mentioned about the Black United Fund.
Mm-hmm.
I know the brother that started that organization, but, you know, I didn't know that he did that. This brother currently teaches at Lincoln. And we've been friends for 25 years, but he's similar to you. He does work, but it's not like, you know, you know, plenty of people out here in the community that do work and want to let you know they're doing it. Then you got other people that do work and just do it for the love of what they're doing. And they don't care whether you know it or not. Well, this brother, his name is Earl Bowen. He's like that. He does things, I'm talking about on a large scale, that you don't know nothing about. Now, one day I went to a meeting up there at the Black United Fund building, because they still have that building up there on North Broad Street. You know where it is, up there at across from the Uptown, with the old Uptown. I went in there for a meeting, and when I went up to the meeting room, I passed by the office, and the director called me in there just to talk for a few minutes. And I looked on the wall, and I seen a big picture of him up there. And I said, oh, wow, I know that brother. And they said, well, he was our founder. I just couldn't believe it. And then when I went back to him and asked him about it, he said, yeah, well, yeah, I did start that organization. But the thing that took them down, and he explained the whole thing to me, and I'm going to give credit where credit is due, even when you're talking about that former mayor that was involved, that took responsibility for bombing black neighborhood. Wilson Good, and it stemmed out of that, the thing in Gary that you was talking about. They approached him about their idea of a Black United Fund, but they wanted it to be a payroll deduction, similar right. to all of these other white United, a March of Dimes and all this other stuff, because you can dictate, they'll give you a slip. I remember when I was working for the government, they'll give you a slip in the beginning of the year and you can mark off what you want to go in right. every pay, whether it's a dollar, 50 cent or whatever out of your pay. You don't even see it. So before Good ran for mayor, they went to him and talked to him about what they wanted to do. And he told them, well, I'll promise you, if I become mayor, I'll make sure that you can have access to payroll deduction. And once he became mayor, he gave the Black United Fund access to thousands, tens of thousands of municipal workers in the city that were black.
Mm-hmm.
And they put the deductions down to come out of their pay every pay. So you had, that organization raised millions of dollars very quickly.
I remember.
And the rug was pulled out almost immediately when Earl said that they gave money to Mumia for his defense. Now, Earl told me in confidence, and I hope I'm not, because I intend to have Earl on. The man has got a lot of ideas, brilliant ideas, about how we can do these things and raise funds and things of that nature. I just got to get him to come on the air. But he told me, he said, listen, you know, if I could do that, if I would do it again, I might not have done it in that fashion. I guess he thought of some type of creative way to do it. But he said that, they, you know, it became public that they gave Mumia a defense fund, you know, during that trial
right.
for his lawyers and his defense. And they the city immediately pulled the rug out from under them, took them mm-hmm. off the payroll deduction, and the organization went. They didn't go in the tank, but they're only a shell of what they once was.
And the National had the same challenge out of New York. I mean, it's you know, because it was a looser federation, but they had the same they had the same kind of upstart, and you know, and the same kind of something taking place, which pulled. I mean, the money was coming in, and again, it wasn't just about the money. People trusted the mechanism that the money went to the
exactly.
organizations because that they were supposed to go to.
Okay,
and,
yeah,
and those organizations were doing work.
Doing work. They were doing work. Doing work. And immediately.
And this goes to the heart of whether, you know, what we live in, the environment, really do they want us to succeed as a people? Because, I mean, the freedom, I mean, Omawale Africa mentioned about the Freeman Bank. I mean, black people poured money into that. They poured money. I mean, and he made reference to, you know, those what it was able to finance, but it was the shenanigans. I mean, of the white controllers once they seen all this money coming in there from white people.
Yep.
To where they started using the money for their own purposes. This is the white and behind the scenes, and black people lost trust. I mean, people first moment out of enslavement was putting millions of dollars into these banks.
Into
that bank. And yeah. and seeing, and then they seen, and so, you know, the lessons learned, history being that instrument that gives us, it's right before us, you know. But yeah, that's Black United Fund is a good example. I'm glad you're in communication with that person, because maybe it can provide us some insight on, you know, to the question that you asked. So how do we prevent it, protect as institutional buildings like Afrocentricity International move towards its goals.
Yeah, well, Richard, come up to the end of another program. I want to give out the lineup. And, you know, some things being done with the website, hopefully moving into this, what they consider new calendar year. In January, we're going to have a revamped site, some black products added to the site, a lot more interactive, some changes being made, put it that way. And I'll kind of let the folks know what's going on when they log on to timeforawakening.com. In the coming weeks, we'll be able to kind of go over some of the new stuff, new features, new things being added. Before we go this evening, I want to talk about the lineup. We have African Perspectives with Brother Oshi, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. Always an interesting conversation with Brother Oshi on African Perspectives. Black Reality Think Tank on Tuesday with Dr. William Rogers from 8 to 10 on Time for an Awakening. On Wednesday, Revive with Sister POC from 8 to 10 on Time for an Awakening. Relationships with Joy and Troy on Thursday from 7 to 8 on Time for an Awakening. And then on Friday, Time for Awakening is back from 8 to 10 on Time for an Awakening. I want to thank everybody for listening to the program this evening. Lively discussion, as always, and we'll be back on Friday, Lord willing, to continue on this path towards an awakening. Peace.
Peace.
If you're driving through the country on a lazy afternoon, or you're watching your children playing after school, they seem to be so unaware of, I know, the things that they'll soon have to take care of. Children, soon it will be their turn to try and save the world. Right now they seem to play such a small part of.
save the children. To save the children.